Morning.
Stella's here. Hi, Stella.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Thanks for coming in early.
Sure,
I think you're actually one of our earlier guests. Because usually we do them at 1, which is why I was running around. So apologies for that.
Okay.
But also thank you for being a late addition.
Yeah.
For making time for it.
Sure thing.
So just as a quick intro, Stella and I met at Columbia. I think you were a year more advanced than I was.
Mm-hmm.
And then we ended up working at offices that were neighbors, literally like shared a wall on Varick Street. And then now you're a co-founder of your own practice. Is it Bureau V or Bureau 5?
Bureau V, right. As in victory.
I was like, I should have asked that before. And how long have you guys been a practice together?
We founded the studio in 2007, I think, which makes it 11 years old. It sounds crazy to say that, but.
And when you started it, was it already with Peter and Laura?
No. So in the beginning, we started with Peter Sussman and Alex Pincus, and so all three of us went to GSAP together at Columbia, and we basically started it out of my apartment. I think Peter was at Diller Scofidio. Alex and I were both working at Asymptote, and we decided to leave our respective jobs and start something new. So we basically worked out of my apartment, bought a plotter, which I put in there as well, printed up some business cards, and applied for the LMCC. They had these residency programs. I don't know if you're familiar with them. After 9/11, they rented out a lot of the Wall Street area office spaces, which were empty. And so the LMCC got a space in Pine Street, which they reserved for artists, and we applied to that program under this idea of doing a drawing project, like large-scale multimedia drawing projects, and did sort of kickstarted our practice by doing that for 3 months, did an exhibition towards the end of it, and started hustling for other work during that time as well.
So, I mean, you guys started it, I guess, a year before the recession?
Was it like
in the...
No, it was right before
right
it.
Before.
And then right when the recession hit was when we got our first project.
Oh, really?
So it was kind of a weird timing.
What was that first project?
That was the music venue, actually.
Oh, amazing.
Which was, I mean, we had done smaller work before that. We had done some installation for Mary Ping for Slow and Steady Wins the Race. And we had also done a proposal for a facade renovation of a commercial building through a friend of ours. But we were approached by one of actually Peter's artist collaborators and Mary Ellen Carroll. He had done some work for her before. And she had a friend named Kevin Dolan who was looking for inexperienced architects based in Brooklyn. And we kind of fit that description
really
well. So he came into our office and met with us and basically decided to work with us.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he was a first-time developer in that sense. His background was in finance, and he just wanted to. But he was an amateur composer and musician, and he wanted to create some kind of a music venue that was more geared towards experimental and new composers. Which also was not like a black box theater, but something more special.
I take it he was he pretty young when he approached you guys?
Well, I think he was in his 50s.
Oh, okay.
He had already had a career, or was in the middle of having his career, but was having second thoughts. Well, not second thoughts. I think he was looking for another project to work on.
Mm. Yeah. I wouldn't say lucky, because obviously I think it was probably through people you knew and kind of establishing those connections, but it's an amazing thing to find someone or someone find you that was looking for that experience.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
Will,
I think someone from Arab told us, he's like, you know, this isn't normal, right? This is a once in a lifetime
so
deal.
Easy.
Yeah, it's never this easy. And he's an ideal client, by the way. he's not a mean guy.
Did the recession at all affect how you guys went about the project?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we kind of, because we were working on that as a small studio, it actually kind of funded our work. And for a while, it was the only work we had, I would say. But it was enough because of its scope. And in the meanwhile, I mean, we did do other projects in between, artist collaborations, as we always do. And, but yeah, I mean, I'd say we were strangely enough not touched by the recession, also because we were starting out so small. Mm-hmm. We weren't starting out in a place where we were making a lot of money to mm-hmm. begin with. So we were just moving our way up, and we kind of made it through that. Also, for the first part of the recession, I was in Germany for 2 years.
So were you still working on the project, though?
Yeah, I was working remotely. So there was a residential component of the project and the music venue. We had actually kind of like split that up, where I was working on the residential project and then also on the music venue, but mostly responsible for the residential project. Yeah, I mean, this was also tricky, kind of working remotely for 2 years from abroad, which is also why I had to come back, actually. It wasn't really sustainable.
So you guys got that project in 2008 or so?
Yes.
And then when did it open?
2015.
So that was a big chunk of, yeah. I guess, your studio time.
Yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, during that time, we've done other work, too, but that was kind of our big... You know, definitely our first building project. Mm-hmm.
I was curious because, you know, obviously, like, not a lot of studios get to start off with a nice project like that.
Yeah.
But even in that period before it was completed, mm-hmm. how did you guys expand into other work or sort of announce yourselves and pick up more things as that was going along?
Well, I think we always had a great network of friends in fashion and art. And mm-hmm. so a lot of our sort of complementary work has been in those fields. We've worked consistently with Mary Pink, for example, on like 5 or 6 different projects over the years. We had some relationships from before, like Peter Zussman had already worked with an artist, a Brazilian artist named Arto Lindsay, and had done a few performance-based pieces with him. We continue to work with Ellie Sudbrek, who's of Assume Vivid Astrofocus. Mm-hmm. So we work with him on these sort of more architectural art installations, and we're doing one in Miami, for example, right now as well. So we just sort of continue to sustain these relationships, and it's been mostly through word of mouth as well, mostly friends and friends of family or any connection, really. And we put ourselves out there, and we also do work that's not always, you know, say design oriented. Like, we do have to pay the bills as well, so we'll do the apartment renovations, the townhouse renovation, that sort of stuff. And not all the work we do makes it onto our portfolio, but, you know, that's kind of what working in New York City is.
You were describing before we hopped on the sort of work you're working on now, and it's an amazingly eclectic set of work. And actually mm-hmm. the scales seem really diverse and actually quite large and interesting.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Congratulations.
I'm like, yeah.
They are. was there a noticeable... leap, I guess, once National Sawdust was completed and you could show it off as a finished project?
We got a lot of great press from it, but I have to say, and, you know, at some point we did start working with the Brooklyn Public Library because they realized that we could do some of their more public spaces as mm-hmm. well. But not everyone's on the market for a music venue, as it turns out. A few people have come out, reached out to us actually with interest in mm-hmm. sort of looking at renovations of their music performance spaces, but we haven't had anything of that scale materialize yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, the BPL, you know, that's actually, I'm not sure I'm supposed to talk about that. it's that one's sort of ongoing. I know we can't talk that. I know there we can talk about them as a client, but the scope of the work is
it's okay. I mean, what's interesting is the clients seem very, which makes sense, I guess, like they see a project like this performing arts center, this music center, mm-hmm. and typically only equate it to being able to do another music venue.
Right, which we're fine with.
If anybody has music venues, BRV. But it's besides even getting that first project, which I think you guys are very fortunate with and mm-hmm. did well, but even expanding to other program types,
right.
which I feel like most architects assume you can, you know, we can do public spaces, we can do all these things that are right. tangentially related. Mm-hmm. do you find that difficult still to convince clients like, oh, we did a music venue, but actually it doesn't mean that's the only thing we can do?
Right. That's true. I mean, actually, I'd say for that reason, we might have struggled to get residential work, actually, mm-hmm. because we don't feature it on our website. We've definitely done it before. But I'd say from like a maybe a PR standpoint, it's not really where we want to focus the visual presence of our studio. On the other hand, yeah, this is sort of a conundrum, actually. How do we publicize that work? And we do, how do we let people know we can do that work? It's just sort of, and in that case, we end up working a lot with friends who just know us and who trust us to do that type of work. But I think part of it is that we usually end up trying to convey to our potential clients that we have the expertise in music venues, but that it, you know, conceptual thinking about a space and how people live and use a space is not restricted to just music venues. We were also very new at that at the time, and feel like we created a successful project then. So residential, for example, is totally different, and there are other institutional types of buildings we're interested in working on. And it's really a matter of understanding that there's a certain amount of research and also like willingness to kind of step out of what we know to kind of create a project.
I mean, you said you launched it in 2007, maybe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So pre-recession, everything was kind of booming then. I mean, there was a ton of work, a ton of money. The kinds of projects were, if not necessary, very exciting anyway.
Yeah. Like
there were giant, ridiculous things going on. Why did you guys... Part of the question is, like, did you always think you wanted to start a practice, but why did you guys decide that you needed to jump out and start your own thing at that point?
I was burned out. I had been working for 2 years at another firm, and I just felt like it was right. I was ready to sort of try my own thing. Well, I'd say I was sort of mentally ready, but in terms of what I think my experience was at the time, I don't think 2 years of working in design was actually enough if I were to start on my own, which is why I really felt good about having partners who had different expertise or areas of expertise. But when I look back, I do think that I could have benefited from staying in the workforce longer, for sure. I also had some savings, and I knew that I could rely on my family to help out financially. And that is, for one thing, I think an issue with the profession is that it's hard to start out on your own if you don't have family support. And so, that being said, I think that, the profession itself kind of needs, I think we need to be better paid as architects in general. I did manage to save something, but there's no way on the current salary, I think average salary that architects make, that one could do that comfortably.
When you guys were starting off, did you and Peter and Alex discuss not only the kind of work you wanted to do, but sort of like the kind of firm you wanted to run?
The
culture you wanted to create in the firm?
Yeah.
The things you couldn't do and could do and things like that?
Well, a lot of that sort of evolved. I mean, in terms of the kind of work we wanted to take on, I think we were all on the same page. We wanted it to be fun and experimental, and we were pretty open for anything as long as there was some kind of feeling of exploring new concepts within shapes or forms or anything, materials. As long as we felt like we were learning something new as an extension of our education, for example. But beyond that, we weren't really choosy about the type of work we wanted to do. And we did, I do recall, like, we wrote up a little business plan with a little manifesto about what we wanted to do, and it involved something about exploding hearts and stuff. So it was very, like, about our friendship and also about these feelings that we wanted to have as we worked. Just sort of capturing that joy of creating that we had during grad school, for example, which we all shared.
I was really curious, actually, because we went to the same grad school.
Yeah.
How much you thought Columbia versus, let's say, your work experience versus other experiences prepared you for starting a practice? I mean, whether it's practically or actually conceptually or mentally.
Yeah. Well, I think Columbia, it was a great place for me to kind of find my identity in a way, my sort of creative identity, or figure out what the issues, at least at the time that I was interested in pursuing, or topics. And that's actually evolved over the years, but or changed into something totally different. But it did give me a sense of, yeah, just like a stronger sense of identity as to what I wanted to do with a practice, and where I felt inspiration, I guess. It's sort of a fuzzy word to say that. I kind of don't like it. But just to feel like motivated to get out of bed and do something that is of value. Now, I start to question what is valuable over the years, because I feel like some of the stuff I was interested in earlier on isn't actually valuable anymore. There are other things that are more valuable. But
and I also have a family, right?
I have a family. Yeah, that's valuable.
Well, in case, I'm sure that also changes.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, like I don't want to be at home later than six. Like that I value. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. I felt like, and the work experience definitely taught me a lot about what I wanted a work environment that I create to be. But I also realized what I didn't want it to be, you know, like there were a lot of, there's just a lot of ways to make it easier for architects to have a life and kind of enjoy their time and not make it feel like you're using them.
Mm-hmm.
And just this sort of the idea of a work-life balance. And it was always, you know, it did seem to be an age type thing. And on the one hand, for a long time, I thought, well, you know, I was in my 20s. Like, this is what you do. You work your butt off. And I think, in a way, it makes sense. I mean, what else are you going to do? Like, you work really hard. You play hard.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the responsibility of family to go to deal with. So, and then it was always your older guys, older women and men who would leave earlier at, like, 6:30. And mm-hmm. That was acceptable too.
So. I mean, I think so. For listeners who don't know about Stella, you were one of the group of women that came out against Richard Meier,
mm-hmm.
And the kind of sexual harassment that seemed very prevalent at the office, but
yeah.
Let alone in architecture in general. And then you wrote a follow-up op-ed only a month ago, I guess,
mm-hmm.
right? I forget exactly the title, but it was basically, why hasn't anything been done?
I actually didn't title it. They put the title on it, which... I don't know if I would have done the same thing. Like, why doesn't architecture care about me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. That's a question I think I was sort of getting at. But, I was more asking. I was sort of trying to figure out why there hadn't been more kind of activity from the institutions that support mm-hmm. architecture.
And it seemed like one of the points you were making, I think, in that op-ed was maybe what you were touching on before, the general culture of the architecture profession, not really valuing the people that are working in it, the
yeah.
sort of you should feel privileged that you're getting your ass kicked
right.
working these late hours.
Yeah.
Not even touching on the kind of, I guess, privilege, especially of the kind of architecture world
mm-hmm.
and how they can treat the people they work with. At that point, that was before grad school, right? The Richard Meier.
Yeah,
period.
So that was before grad school. I worked for 2 years at Richard Meier's office.
Did you, after that and when you went to grad school, did you know at that point that you wanted to start something to change, or at least have a say in how architecture could be run?
I mean, honestly, actually, Richard's office, aside from the sexual harassment, was actually run well in that sense. Like, you didn't see too many people staying late at work very often on the sort of deadline, or at least in the front office. I think the architects did end up staying a bit later, for sure, maybe closer to 8, which I do think is long,
mm-hmm.
a long work day, for sure. But it wasn't as crazy as some other offices I've seen, actually. They seemed a bit more organized, and my feeling is that sometimes the more established size-wise an office is, there seems to be a balance between the size of the fame of the architect
mm-hmm.
and the size, and sort of maybe the bigger the office is, the more regular the office hours are, the smaller the firm is. Maybe if there are like 15 people, the hours seem a little crazier. Mm. That's, I mean, at least like 10 years ago, my observation. Mm. I don't know how it is now.
But. It definitely seemed like the more starchitect-y the head of the office was, which was usually a white man.
Yeah.
The more expectation there was to work crazy hours and
right.
not really have a life outside the office.
Yeah.
I'm also curious if that's changing. I know even, I think OMA had instituted a policy recently that there's regulated hours now,
mm-hmm.
I think in the last year or two.
Okay.
My friend that was like, I was like, it's amazing. We actually get out at 7 and I can actually leave at 7.
You don't
and
feel guilty about
finally
it.
Started not feeling guilty about it.
Yeah.
But yesterday we had Toshiko Mori and Tay Carpenter on the show.
Uh-huh.
And so we're talking a lot about also what schools are doing and the educational side. I mean, this was specifically for the Me Too and the sexual harassment side of mm-hmm. of the profession. And how, and I think it was also in your op-ed, kind of starting with the educational.
Yeah.
That's where the kind of culture gets ingrained,
right?
In terms of what you can put up with,
mm-hmm.
What your expectations are, how much yeah. you can speak out. And I think they were talking about. I think they're pushing through AIA in terms of you lose your license if you, I was accused or I guess charged with sexual mm-hmm. harassment. I wasn't actually sure what the language was.
Yeah,
but it did. Even though that was a really seemingly good step, it mm-hmm. still seems like, and I guess with the title of the op-ed, it wasn't your title, but it seems like not a lot's being done. I mean, there's right. discussions going on, but it's hard to see real change without a really big cultural change in terms of even the architectural profession.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that, I mean, I just realized, I noticed when we were in school, for example, it was totally normal and acceptable to sort of pull all-nighters for our presentations. And not that the professors were necessarily encouraging that, but it was just part of the culture, right? And so I guess my feeling is that, what schools can do to address this, I mean, we're adults at that point, where the students are all adults. You can also learn how to manage your time, but these schools, I think, it would help them out if they sort of encourage students to manage their time better. And address the fact that there are all these all-nighters being pulled, and it's kind of a health issue as well, and just sort of like it's part of just make it part of the education how you should sort of go about treating your own body, your health in an environment in a workplace. I think it just needs to be added as part of the educational. Experience that they provide. I mean, it's hard. I also think it's different. In studio, you're working on your own work, and there's a sort of like dedication that students have, whether or not they're told. Maybe some students will want to pull those all-nighters anyways, but they need to know that they really shouldn't feel bad about not pulling those all-nighters. Actually, I never really pulled an all-nighter during grad school, except once for building systems. I mean, of all things. So, and I'm pretty proud of that. But I always insist on getting at least a few hours of sleep mm-hmm. before presentation.
You're welcome, building systems. You got the one Stella all-nighter.
Yeah. I'm not an expert on this. It's just these were just sort of my observations I wanted to share. Part of the reason why I wrote the op-ed was because I felt like I thought so many other voices would come forward, kind of pointing to all these different things, all these inconsistencies and all the problems within the profession, and I just didn't hear anything. Mm-hmm. So I tried to kind of consolidate a lot of the thoughts that had been floating in my head into that op-ed, but I'm by no means an expert on, like, workplace harassment issues, but I do feel like I sort of voiced what I think has been going on in a lot of people's heads, that people have been thinking about it.
I think your op-ed was the first time I had read anybody kind of connect the sexual harassment, which was not only obviously in architecture, but becoming much more prevalent in the last couple of years, mm-hmm. at least publicly, and that sort of privilege culture privilege is not the right word, but the late hours and the kind of slaving culture of
yeah.
the architecture profession. I'd never really connected those two things, but it makes so much sense.
Mm-hmm.
Since you published, or since you wrote the op-ed, which was just over a month ago, mm-hmm. have more people come out? Have you seen more discussions arise because of it, or is it still sort of quiet?
It's hard to tell. I mean, I was well, there's a student organization at GSD reached out to me, the Women in Design group over there, and it sounds like they're actively, or they've been doing this for before, you know, since a while. They're actively trying to sort of address this, and I think it's great that it's a student-run organization as well. But in terms of other groups, I have to admit, I'm not really that connected to academia, for example, so I don't actually know what's going on there, and I should probably find out. But it's hard to tell what is happening. No one from the other schools have really reached out to me.
No one from GSAP?
No one from
GSAP. Yo, Amal, what are you doing?
Yeah, no one's reached out to me.
We had a number of chefs on the show the last couple of weeks.
Oh, cool.
And one of the points of discussion, which I thought was really interesting, was because a lot of the chefs, or almost all the chefs, were either chefs of color or LGBTQ advocates and members, I guess. And the note was basically that the shift from very Euro and French-centric cuisine, especially led by white men, was sort of fading away, and now there's such much more appreciation for different ethnic foods, foods that were not really expensive. The kind of Michelin star sort of approval was no longer that essential for things. Mm-hmm. And in general, the culture of cooking and food was becoming much, much more diverse. Mm-hmm. And I like to think architecture is also moving that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure it is. I feel like a lot of things are, but as architecture is, it's also much slower than a lot of other professions. Mm-hmm. So I was just curious, kind of in, even from Richard Meier to GSAP days to now, which is a decade plus, it's been a while. Mm-hmm. I was also thinking about that, it's been a while. Have you seen a shift in terms of the kind of leaders of studios, the kind of professors that are out there, the people that are getting recognition for work?
Right.
Is it getting more diverse? Are more women being represented, or not so much?
I mean, it does look like there are more female deans, which is encouraging. But it's, and I do think it's becoming more diverse, but very slowly. And I don't think we have enough minorities in these leadership positions. And I think part of the problem is that the profession itself undervalues itself every time you have, you know, these internships, unpaid internships, or just minimum wage workers for kids who just got out of grad school. You know, the other problem is that architects generally don't get paid well. So this is kind of the conundrum that we've also been in as well. Like, well, we're not getting paid that much, so we can't afford someone for the salary that they probably deserve to get. How do you reconcile that? But, you know, not sort of unpaid internships, I don't think, are the answer, for example. You have to pay someone, and I've always believed that since the beginning, and you have to also compensate people for their overtime hours if possible, or, you know, either by payment or by giving them free time off later. So we've been trying to do that. I mean, we haven't had too much. We have one full-time employee right now, and so this is our chance to kind of work it out with him. And I have to say, I mean, you know, it's every office is different, and also the culture. I mean, I think a lot of people also, I mean, in the past, I used to think, well, some kids just want to work all these hours, and maybe that's okay, but I just don't think it's okay. I think it's just bad for the profession at large. You know, we pay almost as much as law students, or maybe the same amount of money to go to grad school, but get paid like a quarter of what they do. Mm-hmm. They put in the same crazy hours too, probably, but we are at the bottom of the barrel when it comes to all those professions that are notorious for their overtime, like law, medicine, finance. I mean, architects are like just so underpaid. Mm-hmm. So I would like to see that change, but I think that culturally, also the profession itself needs to figure out how to create value in its own work as well. Well, that's a problem that we need mm-hmm. to kind of work on somehow.
I mean, it was, again, I guess you're up at that kind of understanding of that foundational issue of the profession, that you should value yourself as a professional and value the people you work with,
right.
and how that otherwise helps to exacerbate, I think, the kind of sexual harassment. Again, yeah. that's sort of universal, but specifically with the architecture profession. Because I was actually curious, if have you talked to anybody from Richard Meyer's office since?
I've talked to people who used to be there.
But nobody that's there now?
Not now. I think they've been I talked to one person who has a strong connection to the higher up there, and he was telling me that they've been instructed not to talk
really?
To people from the outside, which I get, you know, why should they? No, I haven't talked to anyone there. I mean, I've been friendly with all the, with most of the, I guess now senior associates who are there, sort of sporadic contact over the years, but obviously since this came out, we haven't been
sure.
in touch.
But because it seems like, I mean, and obviously their office is not unique in this case. I mean, a lot of schools are like this as well, and I'm sure plenty of other offices that where someone in the office has been accused or on that like shitty men list or whatever it is.
Right.
The response always seems to be, you know, a little bit of public apology, a little bit of minimal recourse, and then try to forget it and move on.
Right.
You know, don't talk to anybody that might drag up this stuff again.
Right.
Keep a good face on.
Yeah.
That obviously isn't quite adequate or satisfactory or isn't really changing anything.
I mean, it's so tricky because I think that, you know, the sexual harassment issues are really coming from Richard at that office. And while all the senior management, I think, were definitely aware of it, I do think they felt like they couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, it's not like, I mean, from my observation, and this is my opinion alone, I don't think they liked him anyway. You know,
was it just this kind of like a survival issue at that point?
I do think it was a survival issue. And who's to say that if, you know, I don't know. I mean, I knew I was leaving in 2 years, but if I were there as a senior level architect and have felt otherwise great about my coworkers, and that was the case, I think everyone else at that studio was actually great and supportive and were great people. And I still keep in touch with a lot of them who have since left. But if you're happy otherwise, and decide to stay there for a while, I think it's very hard to kind of leave it behind when you've been there for 10, 15 years. And for this, I do feel bad, but, you know, they have Richard to blame for that with all this negative press they've been getting at this point. And I do think this is kind of a little bit, I mean, I think we all know that it's kind of the price you pay for kind of supporting, as much as it was, I think, you know, not that they liked, you know, as much as they probably disapproved of everything that was going on, by staying in it and sort of keeping quiet, you're still supporting it. I've also questioned the extent to which I could have done more, even while I was there, because I knew someone else was coming in after me, and I think I warned her, but...
And you also got warned, too, right, when you started?
I was warned, yeah. I was warned by a woman who was actually originally his assistant, but she ended up being the director of communications there.
Weird.
That's
crazy.
Yeah. So she warned me. She told me that I should be careful. But I also know that she felt like she couldn't stop me from going there, you know, because he would have been very angry. And what do you do? So that was sort of, there's a difficulty there. But ultimately, the responsibility, the greatest responsibility is actually with him. And I do think that as employees, and especially now, I think it's made easier by the fact that these cases are being brought forth, that and culturally it's more acceptable to talk about it. I think if you don't feel like you're going to get your coworkers' support when you come forward about sexual harassment, it's hard to come forward. But now I do think it's easier, so there's less of an excuse now to keep quiet. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing.
But that was the same. I think you mentioned also that because you hadn't heard, there wasn't a lot of noise or action around these things in you, so that's like, I feel like I need to write this op-ed.
Yeah.
A similar thing, I was like, it was actually quite exciting is not the right word, but interesting and encouraging, I think, when the shitty architecture men Google Doc was floating around.
Because
mm-hmm. everybody, at least in the architecture profession, was talking about it. It seemed very much both out in the open and very hidden at the same time.
Yeah.
I remember for a while, I didn't know if I was allowed to look at it. Because I was like, I think it's only women passing it around, and it's fine. Like, but it was an interesting thing that there was clearly a groundswell there.
Yeah.
But then I feel like it sort of stopped again, or it got out of the press, or people sort of moved on to other things.
Right. Well, and that list has also since been taken down, right?
Has it? I have no idea. I haven't even followed it since.
I saw it, and then I remember even like a month after I'd seen it, they had... they said they were going to put it back up. I could be wrong. Maybe they put it back up. But for a long time, I'd sort of check in just to see what's going on. And it had been taken down and with the promise of another revival. But I don't think that's happened. I imagine because there must have been somebody must have threatened a lawsuit or something, which I guess is understandable. But yeah.
But it was also, I think, one of the recent discussions was also one of the men on the list who had a lot of accusations against him.
Yeah.
Was still very prevalent in, I won't say any names, but a very prominent school, and was still getting invited to lectures and still getting invited to teach, even though...
Right.
And it was one of those things I feel like where... This is one tricky thing, and you see this even with the Kavanaugh hearing, where as much evidence and clarity as there is that something or many things happened,
mm-hmm.
there's... enough excuse for people to look the other way right. and still welcome that person because it benefits them in some way, I guess.
I mean, the thing is, a lot of these people bring a lot to the profession otherwise. You know, they bring great charisma and kind of publicity to their projects, which brings publicity to the profession, and then it helps the school. So this is kind of part of the reason why I think it's hard to shut them out for a lot of these schools. And... I mean, I guess the question is the answer to sort of stop promoting them based on this? And this is a question for the schools to answer, really, to figure out where they stand on that stuff. And, you know, it's a little bit... It's similar to a lot of at least the criticism of the coverage, all this negative... The criticism of the negative coverage coming out on Richard Meier... There are still people who really were inspired by his work and want to treat it as a separate topic, really.
Like, and just to kind of, like, isolate
right.
that little sexual harassment side of him.
Yeah. And I get it. Like, his architecture is amazing. And, you know, I understand the willingness to kind of appreciate the art outside of the artist. But I think at this point, it's clear, and also not just in architecture, but in any other profession, creative profession, where you have... this sort of like cult-like figure who's revered without condition. It just doesn't make sense to have that, because all these people are human beings. They can be incredibly flawed, and that's also part of their legacy. And there's no, like, you know, there's no reason to lament that you can't look at a piece of Richard Meier architect or look at Richard Meier's architecture and just think he's like the greatest guy ever, mm-hmm. the greatest architect, this and that. There's a lot going on there, and this sort of like layered, true, like probably closer to the truth persona that really exists out there needs to be just accepted, really. I mean, or taken into consideration. So I don't know. I mean, I think people who kind of criticized the woman who came forward to say that they're ruining his legacy, I mean, that's crazy. Why should we be criticized for bringing forward a problem that, you know, really messed up stuff that happened at the workplace.
I had no idea there was negative press against the...
Oh, sorry, negative feedback in the comments section of the New York Times.
It's a dangerous place, I guess, in general.
Of course, I read all of them because, you know, that's the only feedback I'm getting, yeah. really, aside from my friends that's who are insane. All supportive. So it's I also want to hear what the counter-argument to all this is, too. So, yeah, I read all that stuff, and this is kind of the sort of emerging... Some of the voices of dissent say, well, this is nothing to ruin a man's career over. His career hasn't been ruined. He's had a great career, you know. And a lot of these people will probably continue to have great careers because you'll always have people who don't consider the whole picture. And it's for really individuals to decide. But also, you know, I mean, when you have development companies, for example, signing on an architect with a problematic history, it says something about them and what they value and what they think is marketable. And I think it's for the consumers to really prove them wrong, and the developers also to kind of recognize that hiring an architect who's been accused of sexual harassment is maybe not the best marketing tool as well. So,
have you considered getting back into teaching or back in academia?
Yeah.
Did you ever teach? Actually, I didn't even ask.
We did. Yeah. Actually, well, I've taught with my partners as a studio at Syracuse and at University of Kentucky. And actually, I'm planning to co-teach with another former classmate, Angie Koh, who has Syracuse. Yeah. Although it's not 100% set in stone, so I maybe shouldn't have said that. Angie, don't get mad. So anyway, that's in the works. but that's for the spring, and then after that, I don't know. But yeah, I've been sort of more interested in teaching recently, mostly. I've avoided it in the past because I think the responsibility is just crushing, and I take the whole idea of teaching super seriously and think that I would want to be totally present and not stressed out about balancing the work and school stuff. Mm-hmm. And I needed to be in a mental space. Like, I've had kids over the last, or I have still young children, and the past few years it wasn't really possible mentally for me to do that, but I'm giving myself a little space to do that.
That seems fair. I mean, I think that the reason I asked is I think also the general interest of how do you balance teaching and working and all these other things, mm-hmm. especially as a young professional, let alone raising a family and all these things. But thinking back that, you know, the privilege that someone like Richard Meier or any released architect has embedded in them to know that they can get away with this kind of stuff and they'll still be, their legacy still will be fine. Their mm-hmm. career will still be fine. They'll still get hired by developers.
Right.
I'm sure it's not a top of mind consciousness, but it's part of who they see themselves as
mm-hmm.
and how they see the profession and how they know how the profession sees them.
Yeah.
Which, again, and thanks to your op-ed, I think seems very much pointed to your first experiences in the architecture profession or even understanding what architecture means,
mm-hmm.
which is basically school,
mm-hmm.
And either indirectly or directly shifting that understanding of who you are as an architect and what you can get away with, what
right.
you deserve to have or not deserve to have, what kind of privileges you should or shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it would be great, I think, for you to also be in those kind of ground floors of students' careers,
yeah.
Even directly or indirectly about these kind of issues. But I think just seeing people run practices in different ways and
yeah.
valuing the people they work with and themselves in different ways would be very useful, I'm sure.
Yeah. No, I just, I hope I have something to offer. I figure after 10 years of practice, I do, actually. So I'm banking on that. I think earlier I was like, well, I'm just like a few years into my practice. There's no way I have anything to offer at this point, but I think now I might. I really mean it. I've had a lot of self-doubt on that.
Amal, call Stella. Well, thank you again for coming in on short notice.
Yeah, sure thing.
And for spending the morning. So, again, Stella is a partner at Bureau V. And whenever you can talk about the work you're doing now, we'll be excited to hear it because it's pretty incredible.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you.